Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
And before we get into the topic this evening, I should introduce myself and say welcome to this final Theology Matters of this series. So I'm Andy Tuck. I've been working at the church here for a couple of years as a student worker here. So I do work amongst the brightest and best in Christchurch London. Yeah, you guys know it. Things about me. So I'm a Southern Englishman. Is one of my defining features. I love my football club, AFC Bournemouth. If you've heard of them, recently promoted to the Premiership and not doing very well in that. I've just finished a novel on the life of Roman orator Cicero. Has anyone heard of him? Excellent series by a guy named Robert Harris. I recommend them thoroughly to you. And I'm also halfway through my theology master's. So I'm a student worker. So I'm doing a part-time master's at a college called St. Melitus College in West London. And I've just started my third year then working for the church here. And to be honest, more than anything, I love being part of a church here that takes God really seriously. I don't mean that we're solemn all the time in the way that we engage with God, but rather that we acknowledge that the Christian message is true, and that there is a living God who loves us and who cares for us so much that he sent Jesus Christ into the world to rescue us and redeem the world and us, and now continues that mission through both his Spirit and the church. And I love the fact that then we take the time we need to get to grips with this truth and kind of what it means for not only our lives, but for our community, for the city, and indeed the world. And this is one of the reasons, I suppose, we're running this Theology Matters course, to give us the time and space to think about sort of big fundamental questions of our faith, as well as giving us opportunity just to dig that bit deeper into specific questions. So we've been looking at the Gospels in depth for the past three terms. So we've done three sets of four talks. This is the final one of them. And we've basically been spending time examining the major themes in the eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life that we see. So we've looked at their historical context. We've explored each gospel in turn, looking at how each gospel writer sort of conveyed their message about Jesus Christ. We've looked at themes of how they've used stories and symbols, parables, signs and wonders, things about the kingdom. Also looked at monotheism, election, temple and Torah throughout the gospels as major themes. Basically, we've got to grips with what they tell us about the nature of God and his salvation plan for the world. There's loads of excellent material. All of them have been recorded. So if you want to go back and listen to all of those, I thoroughly recommend you do. They're on our website and you can do it. But my job today is then to conclude this series. And we're going to do that by concluding where the Gospels do in Jesus' resurrection. And like our other sections, so we're going to separate the time into a bit of, I suppose, more formal teaching like this, but also to discussion. So I'd like to get you guys into groups to think about the Gospels themselves. And as I say before, do feel free to ask questions or interrupt me. I gave everyone a handout, right? So everyone's got one of those. We'll look through that as we go on together. So now one of the first things that we need to be aware of when we look at the resurrection is our currently advanced chronological position in the history of the world. By that I mean we are in a place where we can look back on the event of the resurrection. It's something that we look back on and see is history. And that this extraordinary event has had a couple of millennia to affect the church's theology and thinking. So much so that I sometimes wonder that we can kind of take it a bit for granted. But when we look into the Gospels, we're looking back into events that unfolded in real time and space. And for almost the entirety of the Gospels, so 95% of their chapters are pre-resurrection. So in many ways, the four Gospel accounts we have show the disciples and others wrestling with the reality of God breaking into space and time as a man, who lived and then died and then rose again, and with each of these being worldview shattering events. And I find it fascinating then that throughout the Gospels, before Jesus' crucifixion particularly, people are always confused when Jesus talks about kind of his main purpose on earth and as he looks forward to his death and resurrection. I put a few of those verses on the handouts for you on the bottom right bit of your handout. And you can see there the disciples' reaction when Jesus talks about his death and about his resurrection, and their kind of emotion swinging from anger to sadness to confusion, and then all the way back again. I can kind of imagine the disciples huddling round together after Jesus has just said one of these statements and sort of saying to each other, like, what on earth do you think he means that he's going to rise again, says one. I have no idea, says another. Well, I don't know, but I'm sure I don't like it then, proclaims Peter. Like, and to help us understand this spectrum of emotion, we need to spend just a bit of time thinking and exploring the disciples' context. So we'll start by asking our first question of what did people in Jesus' time believe about the resurrection? Now, it may feel that we're going to skim over some of this material. And if you would like to get some more in-depth death material on this section in particular, I'd encourage you to look back on a series of talks that Liam did a couple of years ago in our series Theology Matters Resurrection. So he spent a whole session sort of unpacking some of this history that we're going to look at now. You can find those talks on our website alongside this current series. But let's start by thinking about the Old Testament. And as a whole, it doesn't really have much to say on the topic of the afterlife. I think we can easily misread the first verse of the Bible if we're not careful. That verse states, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And we can imagine God creating the earth where we dwell now and heaven as a place where we go to when we die. But if we look through the Torah, so that's sort of the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, if we look through the story there, or to be honest, even the first chapter of Genesis, we can see that heaven very often actually simply means sky. So this verse could actually be better rendered that in the beginning God created the sky and the earth. And kind of this is the world that the writers of the Old Testament were primarily then concerned with, the physical world, not a spiritual world. But having said that, there are a number of different views about the afterlife that emerged through the Old Testament. There was one mainstream view that probably about 9 out of 10 Jewish guys would have held. So if you imagine the average Jew of the time, we'll call him Joe Jew. This is kind of what he would have thought. And it's the first one on our handout there. It's this of life, love and land. So his main conceptual framework would have been based around the trio of these three things, love, life, and land. And this is, in a nutshell, the story of the Pentateuch, so those first five books of the Bible, the basis of the Torah. And we can see this framework develops through how this framework develops through reading the story. So you guys will probably be quite familiar with this, but let me run through four steps. So firstly, man was commanded to populate and rule over the world. So we read about that in Genesis 1, 26 to 30. These are the verses where we read that humanity is made in God's image and where God gives the command to be fruitful and increase in number, to fill the earth and subdue it. I heard one teacher summarize it as, this is basically God telling us to have sex and travel lots. Commandments I think that we all agree are pretty cool. But then secondly, we know that man then gets it wrong. The land is corrupted, life is forfeit, and the relationships, the love, are ruined. So you can read about that in Genesis 3, particularly God's pronouncement on mankind in verses 16 and 19. That in the fall there we see humanity's relationship with God, with other humans, but also with nature itself, are all corrupted. But thankfully, the story doesn't stop there. So thirdly, God offers restoration to one man, Abraham. And you can read in Genesis 15 that God there declares out of everyone, he's picking Abraham, that he will be a nation and the nations will be blessed as a result. And then also crucially, fourthly, God also offers then salvation to this offer of restoration to Abraham's offspring. So you can read about that in places like Exodus 6, verses 7 and 8, where we read of God saying to Israel that they will be blessed, to be a blessing to the nations too. So this is the mainstream view that kind of most Jews would have believed, that the purpose of life is to continue your lineage, to be God's representatives, and to dominate a small plot of land. This is what the majority of the Old Testament then is concerned with, people's lives in the promised land in right relationship with God and not in what comes after their lives. That being said, there are on occasions in the Old Testament where you get hints of the life that is beyond. So these views don't necessarily unfold chronologically through the Old Testament, but instead, at different times and in different places, there are three minority views which emerge, which are again listed on your handout. So firstly is the idea of sleep. Now, there are a whole host of verses that point to a time of unconsciousness after death. For example, Ecclesiastes 9 verse 10 says this: "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the grave where you are going, there is neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom." And you'll see from your handout as well a list of whole other verses that you can delve into to your own time to see this idea of sleep, this next to nothingness. And coupled with this next to nothing notion was being able to disturb the dead. This comes from a curious incident in which King Saul and the witch of Endor conduct a seance with the dead prophet Samuel. So you can read about that in 1 Samuel 28, verses 11 to 19. But alongside that, alongside this view, there is also that there's a deliverance from the place of death called Sheol. It's a participation in glory after death. And then we get to the view that people would wake up after death to resurrection. And again, there's a list of verses there. Probably the most famous of those passages is the Ezekiel 37 one and the prophecy of the valley of dry bones that we see there. Now, for Ezekiel there, the issue of uncleanness and resulting judgment of the people of Israel is kind of his key concern in that passage. And within that context, the most unclean thing that people in the day could come across was an unburied corpse. So this is an incredibly striking image and imagery for Ezekiel to use. But he also uses this imagery then to think metaphorically about the nation of Israel. So no other Old Testament writers took this to be a literal resurrection. It was later readers who read it in this way, so that they read of life returning to these bare bones. And this fourth view was a real minority. No one outside of Judaism would have believed it at all. Everyone knew and everyone knew that dead people stay dead. Even many passages listed on your many passages listed on your handout in this section use the language of resurrection to what would happen to the whole nation rather than just referring to individuals. So remember, one of the major themes in the national psyche of Jewish people would have been these themes of exile and restoration. So these verses would have primarily been read in that light. But where are we left then with at the end of the Old Testament, given all these different views? So we have the mainstream view that you lived for land and for children to represent God on earth. And then you had these minority views of sleep, disembodied glory, and then resurrection. And yet the striking thing is that by the time we get to the New Testament, so you open up the Gospels and start reading those, the physical, like a future physical resurrection, is by far the most mainstream view. Jesus openly refers to it. The Sadducees are the only minority group we read about in Judaism at the time who do not believe in a resurrection. So this leads us to question, so what happened between the end of the Old Testament and the start of Matthew? Well, in short, the Greeks happened. The Old Testament was written in Hebrew, but then it was translated into Greek, and it's called the Septuagint. The title, so the Septuagint there, literally means the translation of the 70. And so it's the Roman numerals LXX for 70, right? 50, 10, 10. Refer to these legendary 70 Jewish scholars who translated the five books of Moses into Greek, probably about the 3rd century BC. And even though Greek thinking would have heavily been influenced by philosophers such as Plato, who believed in immortality, not resurrection, the translators have rendered the Septuagint with a resurrection bent, which is really fascinating. So, for example, you can look at ambiguous passages. So sort of like Hosea 13, verse 14, where more clarity is brought to them. So Hosea 13, 14 reads in the Hebrew, "Shall I redeem them? Shall I ransom them from the power of Sheol? Shall I redeem them from death?" And it becomes in the Septuagint, "I shall rescue them from the hands of Hades, and I shall redeem them from the death." All right, no worries. Grab a hand up. We're on the second page. You're welcome. So we're just starting to look at the Septuagint. So it's the on the handout, the IT in the middle arrow, and then the LXX translation. Great. So we're just looking at Hosea 13, but we also see then, so in Job 14:14, so it says, if a man dies, shall he live again? So in the Septuagint, becomes simply, if a man dies, he shall live. Now, we may think then that these translators simply got it wrong. However, we must remember that their natural philosophical bias would have been towards immortality and not towards resurrection. And in this way, they were working really hard to render an accurate translation of the Hebrew that they were working from. And we can also take comfort from the fact that both Paul and Jesus are both quoted from this translation of the Bible, of the Old Testament as well. But then, at the end of the Old Testament, people actually did continue to start to continue to write and collect their writings in what we now call the Apocrypha. Now, these can often feature in the Catholic Bible, but they're only really considered secondary scripture. They kind of do have interesting parts to them, but they're not all sort of wacky and crazy writings that you may have read about. But bits of them are actually just straightforward history in terms of the intertestamental period that we're looking at here. And these are really interesting to study because we kind of start to see this development of theology in regards to resurrection. So just a word about a couple of passages in there. In one of the books, 2 Maccabees, it's one of the history books in there. It celebrates the rededication of the Jewish temple after the Jews rose up in rebellion against their Seleucid oppressors. The Seleucid Empire was kind of a remnant of one of the remnant kingdoms out of Alexander the Great and his great empire. It then split up into lots of different ones. The Seleucid Empire was the one that was kind of around Syria, modern-day Syria. So these Seleucid guys were oppressing them. They had outlawed Judaism, defied the temple. But the Jews were led by this guy named Judas Maccabeus, and the Jews then rose up against this great persecution. But many Jews then were martyred as a result. So just like Daniel 12 in the Old Testament, the story there that we may be familiar with the persecution that comes on the people in exile in Babylon at the time, it was a time of overwhelming difficulty for people. And it's in this situation that many turn to thoughts of resurrection as a sort of comfort and as a solution. So Maccabees contains several stories of many Jews at the time that were not only hoping for a future awakening after death, but were indeed forfeiting their lives for the certainty of resurrection. Now, one of the most gruesome tales is told to us in 2 Maccabees 14. And there's a Jewish elder there called Razi who, when finding himself surrounded by a group of these Seleucid soldiers, actually falls on his own sword to kill himself. But the passage reads, "But in the heat of the struggle, he did not hit exactly," as in like he didn't kill himself very well, so he's still alive. So, and with the crowd now rushing in through the doors, he courageously ran up on the wall and threw himself down onto the crowd. But as they drew back, a space opened and he fell into the middle of the empty space. Still alive and aflame with anger, he rose, and though blood gushed forth and his wounds were severe, he ran through the crowd and standing upon a steep rock, and with blood now completely drained from him, he tore out his entrails, right, so all of his insides, right, and threw them with both hands and hurled them at the crowd, calling on the Lord of life and spirit to give them back to him again. Told you it was a bit grim, hey? That's a gory story. So when poor Razi here mentions life and spirit, it's a reference to Genesis, and kind of the point is clear that he's hoping for a future resurrection because he's given up his life for God in this life. So a second development in the Apocrypha links resurrection to the end times, whereas previously it seemed that the resurrection was expected to happen in this age. So here's a passage from another book there, so 1 Enoch, and it says this, "As for this fragrant tree, not a single human being has the authority to touch it until the great judgment, where he shall take vengeance on all and conclude everything forever. This is for the righteous and the pious. and the elect will be present with its fruitful life. And he will plant in it in the direction of the northeast, upon the holy place, in the direction of the house of the Lord, the eternal King. Then they all shall be glad and rejoice in gladness, and they will enter into the holy place. Its fragrance shall penetrate their bones. Long life will love on earth, such as your fathers lived in their days. So this chapter doesn't explicitly talk about the resurrection, but it kind of expects some sort of vindication at the end, when kind of everything is concluded. A later chapter is more overt. So this is 1 Enoch 62. The righteous and the elect ones shall be saved on that day. And from henceforth, they shall never see the faces of the sinners and the oppressors. The Lord of the spirits will abide over them, and they shall eat and rest and rise with that Son of Man forever and ever. The righteous and elect ones shall rise from the earth and shall cease being of downcast face. They shall wear the garments of glory. Now, this chapter adds a surprising element. I wonder if you picked up that this rising is linked with the Son of Man, a loaded phrase that we'll know from seeing how Jesus used that. So perhaps here then is this emerging view that this messianic figure, this Son of Man, might be the one that would usher in the resurrection. Now, the various interpretations of these the passages and the rest of Scripture, the Old Testament, led to a formation of various different theological groups. So we get the Pharisees and the Sadducees are probably the most famous ones, and were certainly the most active participants in Jewish life at the time of Jesus. So let's just look briefly at each of these groups and kind of what they would have thought. So the Pharisees believed in the resurrection, but they didn't always agree on who would be raised or indeed when they would be raised. And it had really interesting implications for how they viewed civil life or different laws. So they still used a death penalty, but in such a way as to preserve the bones of people for the resurrection. So stoning was moderated. Burning was to be done by forcing liquid, like a burning liquid, down the throat. Strangling was done in a particular method. All of this was in aid of keeping the bone structure intact. So the body was important. Its most durable parts, the bones, were then to be rescued from destruction. So cremation was often avoided for the same reason. The Sadducees, on the other side, so these were the ruling elite. They included the high priestly family, those guys in charge. They were essentially the top dogs of the organized religion of their day. Traditionally, they are believed to have come about in the 2nd century BC. But these guys didn't believe in the resurrection at all. So one Sadducee rabbi wrote this: "You should not be like slaves serving their master for the sake of receiving a gift, but like slaves serving a master without any prospect of receiving a gift." And so they saw, as the resurrection is a gift from God, then the Sadducees rejected that idea. Instead, they focused on only reading the Torah, and therefore still held the Old Testament mainstream view that there was indeed no resurrection. Just as an aside, it's quite interesting to think about this group and sort of practical reasons why they wouldn't have enjoyed sort of thinking about the resurrection. So as we've seen during the Maccabean Revolution, sort of revolution was used to encourage martyrs or revolts. So we can see if these guys are the ruling elite, you can see why they might want to squash down a system of thought that encourages people to rebel or to lead to martyrdom. So these Pharisees and the Sadducees bitterly disagreed about the appearance of the resurrection in the Torah. You can see, for an example, the story of Paul before the Sanhedrin, that is the ruling council of Judaism at the time. So you can read about it in Acts 23, verses 6 to 10. And there he kind of throws in this theological bombshell into the mix about the resurrection, and then just watches it go off and the argument ensue amongst them. It just shows how seriously they disagreed on this issue. So we can kind of conclude this section. We can say that by the time Jesus was born, many Jews, but by no means all, believed in the resurrection. So the resurrection didn't simply mean some kind of vague life after death, but meant a physical, bodily coming back to life after an interim period of soulish consciousness. The resurrection is therefore life after life after death. It meant a hope for the future and a fulfillment of the promises of Israel. They may not see all of the land taken and Jewish rule established in their lifetime, but when it came, they lived in this belief that they would be resurrected to enjoy that new age. So no one really knew when the resurrection would happen. No one really connected it with the Messiah's resurrection. With their own, really, until the arrival of Christianity in the first century. So, having skimmed over all of that, any questions on that section so far? Kind of about Jewish thoughts on the time about the resurrection. Great. Let's move on then to think about the Gospels themselves. So, with this in mind, with this context, and with this kind of story, let's now together explore more directly how the Gospel writers would have portrayed the resurrection. So, if you want to turn over the page on your handouts, and we'll go to the page with the three boxes on like that. So, how did the different Gospel writers portray the resurrection? And to help us look more deeply into each of the gospel narratives, I'd like for us to do this basically to split you into three groups, with each group thinking about one of the gospels. So I'll get you guys to think about Matthew, Mark, or Luke. I'll cover John in just a bit. But for each of these gospels, I'd like you to think about the features they do emphasize about the resurrection and Jesus' appearances afterwards. So concentrate on those chapters, so the Matthew 28, Mark 16, and the Luke 24. Now, one thing you'll notice when reading the chapters in the Gospels concerning the resurrection in a moment, that each of the Gospels presents the resurrection of Jesus very factually. There is little theological reflection in the Gospels themselves that comes later in the New Testament, places like 1 Corinthians 15. Now, when doing a Bible study, I find it really helpful to think about three questions, or three types of questions. So observation, interpretation, and application. So that is observation, what does this passage say? Interpretation, what does this passage mean? And then application, so what should I do as a result? So for our purposes today, as you look at these chapters, focus on the observation. So what does this passage say? And the interpretation, what does this passage mean? And looking at your passage then, and see what it says, and asking what meaning that it might hold. Just a couple more things to say before you get stuck into this this task. Now, I know not all of you would have been here at the start of the series, so just a tip for you. When looking at the gospel that you're focused on, it's often helpful to keep in mind the sort of major overarching theme of the gospel. So to recap on those for each of them. So in Matthew, Jesus is seen as the new Moses. In Mark, Jesus as the Son of God, Son of Man, Son of David, and the guy who's taking on the powers. And then in Luke, Jesus is the new King David. So think about this in connection with the passage that you read. So in this exercise, look at how the gospel writers bring out the theme. So kind of pay attention to where the events are happening, who is involved, what are just the main features of the text. If you guys take about 10 minutes or so, but if we don't need that much time, great. If you need a bit more, we can also be flexible with that. Take about 10 minutes to read the gospel, read it through, discuss it, and then we can come back together and share it as a big group. If you do get through the sort of the gospel and you feel you've nailed it, please feel free to look at the others as well. It's often quite fun to compare them. Why don't we split, so we do two threes and a two, if that's all right. So if we just do like you three and then middle three and then you two at the end, maybe if that works. If you know, look at those people around and go, no, I'd prefer to be in a different group, please, you know, you can change. Why don't you guys just take 10 minutes and then we'll feedback. It might be cool that as we go through each, if we just have the passage, if you've got it available in front of you, so that when the group like feeds back, they can talk about some of the themes and you can see it just a bit more readily in front of you. Let's start with the New Testament, does in Matthew. So if you guys want to share a bit just in terms of how you feel Matthew, so Matthew 28 talks about the resurrection Any themes that he brings out? Yeah.
Like, firstly, like the Great Commission, which I had a lot of parallels with the section in Deuteronomy chapter 31 as well, about like sending the people out and emphasizing that like God is always with them. And
yes.
There was also like another parallel about like being near the mountain, where Jesus sort of is like sort of portrayed to be similar as what Moses did.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's basically, it's amazing, isn't it, that last sort of mountain scene. So if you look at the resurrection bit, you've got the Great Commission right at the end, where kind of Jesus takes his 11 disciples up to this mountain. So you'll see on the handouts, it's got this cross-reference to Deuteronomy. Can you guys tell us just what's happening there? Give us the context for what's happening in Deuteronomy. Yeah.
That they should go into Jordan even though he himself cannot go over.
Yes.
And near the end of the first section, which is verse 7-8, Moses is like telling the people that this is what God has told him. And it's in contrast very similar to what the Great Commission mentioned.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's cool. Like so Moses kind of ends his ministry, I suppose, like on this mountaintop, basically commissioning Joshua and the people of Israel to go and to take the land. Just as Jesus stands on this mountaintop and says to his disciples, "I command you to go into the nations." There's some really striking parallels between the two. You guys touched on a number of them. I'll repeat them partly for the recording, but also let me. Go through them. So it talks about God never leaving you. That's both mentioned. That the Lord himself will go before you. Even similarity of names. So Joshua is actually the same name as Jesus. So God is salvation. So you've even got that as a common theme, this mountaintop commission. In Deuteronomy, go and take the nation. In the Great Commission, go to the nations. And then there's also, so in the Exodus, it's, you know, do all that I have commanded. Jesus here saying, teach, you know, everyone all that I've commanded you. Some really, yeah. Massive parallels between the two. Like, you just read the two side by side. I encourage you guys who haven't done it, read them side by side, and you're like, oh wow, yeah, Matthew really has something clear in mind, something that he's wanting you to have in mind as you read it through. Interesting thing that happens as well, so the guards report, so you guys wouldn't have picked this up if you hadn't read the others in quick succession, but there's a guards report right in the middle of Matthew 28, which is unique to Matthew's gospel, so no one else sort of picks that up. It's quite an interesting inclusion, I suppose, in his summary. Whether it's kind of because he's writing to a more Jewish audience, and so more of them would have been aware of these types of rumours going around, that Matthew was maybe more keen to give an apologetic for, you know, the existence of this rumour and to kind of talk that through. Yeah, so lots of really cool things in there. Anything else that you guys want to add before we move on to Mark's gospel? He never rose,
he said. Like, he never rose. He never came back to life again.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
So I think what Matthew is telling us that this is how the whole Judaism worldview continues on.
Yes.
And, they believe that he never rose because the they say that
yeah.
So how this whole thing continues on even.
Yes. Yeah, that's cool. Any questions the other groups might have for this passage? If not, let's look on to Mark 16. So if you guys want to turn there as well. Our Mark group, can you tell us about some of the features or themes of this passage? What did you guys pick up and read? Any questions that you were left with? Yeah.
At the time.
Yeah, deals with it very curtly, doesn't he?
Yeah. And we believe that the follower of Jesus Christ at the time were afraid, scared of, telling what has actually happened.
Yes.
So they live in fear at that time with the ladies there. We didn't actually, we're not able to see much.
Yeah, it's short, isn't it? Like when I say they steal them quite promptly, yeah, you can totally see that. I find it interesting this confusion that's left with. So if for the minute we think that the Mark's Gospel ends at verse 8, so I don't know if you guys have got this bit in your translation, then verse 9 onwards says earliest manuscripts don't have this. So if we think about verse 8 sort of being the final verse, it was really interesting because you are left with this sense of, like a strange sense of mystery, kind of like what's really happened? I mean, Jesus doesn't really get a final word in. All that you've got is this angel addressing the woman at the tomb and saying, don't be alarmed, Jesus isn't here, he's gone on elsewhere. But then they leave with this sense of doubt and bewilderment, which is quite interesting. One of the things that this sort of pattern of revelation and then confusion is actually one that Mark has played with before in his gospel. So there are three times, for instance, where Jesus talks about his death and resurrection. And then the disciples have basically either rebuked him or been confused, and Jesus has taken the opportunity to teach them some more. So this is kind of the cycle of revelation, then confusion, this kind of not really getting it. Seems that Mark is continuing this on, like this sense of, man, we don't really know what's happened. They obviously realise that something quite significant has happened, but they can't really put their finger on what, which is quite interesting. Mark, another theme of Mark's gospel, he was keen to point towards Jesus as like the suffering servant throughout. So the sufferings of Jesus there. It's in Mark's gospel that we read, if you want to follow me, come and take up your cross. There's a sense of the struggle or the strife that's associated with following Jesus, joining him in his suffering. So it's interesting then that Mark's gospel doesn't seem to end on a high, but rather ends on this bit of confusion. It's almost maybe a more realistic or maybe more pessimistic view of the Christian life, the kind of, hey, there's going to be some struggles, that you're not particularly going to know what's going on, which is quite interesting, I think. Interesting to note then that the longer ending to Mark's gospel seems to include or continue Jesus's confrontation with the powers. So that's often been a feature of this gospel as well. So Jesus taking on the powers, particularly in terms of not only demons and things like that, but then also sort of the authorities that were around as well. That sort of picks some of those themes up as well. Any questions or any other thoughts that people want to put in about it?
I was wondering, you were just talking about, where were the followers, the other 11 men?
Yeah.
Disciples, where were they?
Yeah.
Yeah,
not in this picture, right? Which is really interesting. So, I suppose from other Gospels you pick up that they're kind of praying in another room, in the place where they were. So they were kind of huddling together, like kind of fearful and afraid. So we read in John's gospel, which we'll come to in a bit, where we read of them sort of in that locked room together. So they're obviously scared and frightened of persecution. So they're clearly there. And in the other gospels, we hear reports about the women coming and saying, hey, come and see this, and they do, and all of that type of stuff. So in Mark's gospel, not even a reference to that right there. Just this confusion. So if you read the other gospels, it kind of fills in that bit of a blank. Anything else, or should we move on to Luke? All right, great. Well said, Mary. Okay, so Luke, let's look at Luke 24, which is by far the biggest passage that I gave you guys to think about. So you probably, did you get a chance to chat about it, or did you?
Yeah, we did.
Okay, great.
Yeah. And then Peter goes to look at the tomb, and then there's two guys on the road to Emmaus who Jesus appears to. Then when they realise it's Jesus, they run back, and Peter's seen Jesus, and then he appears to everyone, and then it's the going up to Bethany and going back up to heaven.
Yes.
And notice it kind of felt a little bit like one of those spy movies, or one of those movies with the twist.
Oh yeah, go on.
So the second, I imagine, like, because Luke wasn't one of the original, was he? He was picked up by Paul somewhere along the way.
Yes.
He came back and found out about this later, and he's already quite a smart guy. And I almost get a feeling like he's sitting down with them, listening to their stories, and being like, how did you not figure this out? It's so obvious. And a lot of his work seems to be putting together a picture that there's this twist at the end, and you're like, and this is who Jesus is, and this is what it all means. And he, every time either an angel or Jesus meets with people, he's like, how did you not get this? Let me go over this again. I can't believe I'm having to tell you this again, almost like, this is what it means. This is what was happening. This is what I told you. You know, so there's things like, why are you looking for him amongst the dead? And how could you not realize this is what Jesus was talking about?
Yeah.
And being like, that. Now I'm going to show you everything I spoke to you, that everything written about me and the prophets, like bringing it all together for them. And they're like, oh, okay. Can you imagine if like when you watch that movie the second time around, you start to spot all the things along the way?
Oh yeah, nice.
That meant, that's what that was about.
That's a good illustration.
We didn't really link it to the in the new David. Couldn't quite get that just from that passage.
Okay.
Maybe just the fact that he links it into all of the law. Of
Moses, yes.
All of the prophets and Psalms.
Yes.
And saying like, this is how I fulfilled all of them.
Yes. Spot on. Yeah. The other aspect of it that's interesting to pick up, which you kind of mentioned, where are these events sort of centered around? So even the guys on the road to Emmaus, so they're walking to Emmaus, but where'd they end up at the end of it? Yeah. So it's kind of all around the seat of authority, the sort of the kingly throne. Do you know, it's all kind of pointing back to, because like you say, yeah, they all sort of bounce off, but it all sort of comes back. Interesting that they not only do that sort of geographically, but it's also sort of scripturally as well. You're right, there's a constant, let me take you back to the Psalms, let me take you back to the law, this kind of both places of sort of kingly authority. So not only in the law and kind of how the nations run, but also then in the Psalms, and sort of obviously Dave being the great psalmic king, you know, sort of writing all of these songs and poems about the love of God. So like constant linking up into there. Interesting, I suppose he's setting up Acts as well, doesn't he? Because he says right at the end, stay in the city. So in verse 49, I'm going to send you what the Father has promised, but stay in the city until you have been clothed with power from on high. So I suppose this is setting up Acts and kind of Luke part 2, right? But it's this big build-up of Jerusalem being the seat of this kingly power, like the power coming on people there, which is really, really quite interesting. Great work. That was really good. Anything else or any questions that people have about that sort of, that passage or any of them? Great. Hopefully you can see it's interesting just by reflecting on the different ones, kind of how they bring out different aspects of the resurrection. They're kind of like teasing out these different themes. Let me take you through John's Gospel. I've partly kept this, partly because it's two chapters, so it's really long, but also because it's really cool, and I selfishly wanted to keep it for myself. So let me take you through some of the stuff here. So if you have a Bible, like have it open in front of you, it'd be nice just to jump through them together. So let me briefly sketch out the shape of these couple of chapters for you. So firstly, John takes us through Jesus' resurrection appearances. So firstly with Mary Magdalene, then the disciples, and then lastly then to Thomas, who wasn't with the disciples when he appeared there. And so you get some wonderful verses, these reassuring verses. John then takes us through the purpose of writing his gospel, so that's in 20 verse 30 and 31, basically saying that I wrote these things down that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. And then he rockets into chapter 21, where John then guides us through a series of other post-resurrection appearances that Jesus has with his disciples when they're in Galilee. So there Jesus reinstates Peter, and in a wonderful way. So if you kind of, you might not be able to see it just like by scanning your eyes down, but there's three times that Jesus asks Peter, do you love me? And then Peter replies back, yes, of course I do. And then Jesus sort of affirms him in a particular, in his ministry, in his future direction. It's a lovely picture of the restoration that Peter goes through, given his three denials of Jesus earlier on in the crucifixion narrative that we have there. Interesting that John's really wanting us to pick up that similarity, so he's put in a couple of interesting things to help us pair them up together. So if you compare 21 verse 9, which it says, when they landed, they saw a fire burning with coals there with fish on it and some bread. Interesting then, if you compare that with 18:18, which is sort of the where Peter is denying Jesus, that all happens around a coal fire outside the court that they're warming their hands there. Just another hint that sort of John's putting in his text to help us to see the connection. Now, if you remember back to the structure of John's gospel, you'll know it's structured around sort of the seven I am sayings of Jesus and the seven signs that that accompany them as well. And through these, John is really keen to point us to the fact that that Jesus is the one who is the true and better for so many of these different symbols in Jewish national and religious life. So he really wants us to see that Jesus is the true and better vine, the true and better bread, the true and better temple, the true and better shepherd, etc., etc. Now, seven is a really significant number in the Jewish psyche. Can anyone remember what it represents in sort of Jewish worldview, number seven? Sorry, say again, Eddie? Yeah, perfection, right? Yeah, so seven is this number of completion. Think about the 7 days of creation. I think this then becomes really significant and will bring significance into Jesus' declaration on the cross where he declares, it is finished. So John 19, verse 30. And in that moment of death, Jesus is kind of declaring his earthly ministry to be completed. Now, if seven is the number that points us to sort of the completion of creation, then kind of this eighth sign, so Jesus' resurrection in John's gospel, then I think he's kind of trying to point us towards something new. So let me just show you how John does this, because I think it's really quite cool. So I love the way that John introduces these couple of chapters on the resurrection. So if you have a look at how they start, so John 20 verse 1, which says, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, you know, dot, 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 dot. Now, does that remind you of anything? Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark. Now, think through how other books in the Bible start. Are there any significant starts to a week that you can find? Yeah. Right, so Genesis 1, Genesis 1:1. Can someone just turn to that and read that? Can anyone do that quickly? I'll race you there. So Genesis 1:1. What does it say? Mary, you read it out.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth.
Oh, and then go on to 2.
Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface.
Great, you can start there. So first day of the week and this darkness paired together. And there we read, so in that Genesis 1, we read of the creation of the world, like on the first day of the week, while it was still dark. And you can think about this creative power, this spirit hovering over the waters. Think about the creative power that at that moment was about to be unleashed onto and into the world. Think about the startling new work that God was about to pour forth. Picture sort of the Big Bang right in your head. God God said, let there be light, and boom, there was everything. I think this is what John wants to have us to have, for us to have in mind as we approach these resurrection events. Think about the power of God about to be unleashed on the world through Jesus's resurrection, through his church, as the good news of Jesus spreads throughout the world as a result. See, John here is pointing us towards a new creation, that in the resurrection, something new has begun. And there are details littered throughout this chapter that point to this. And the verse from John 19 as well is just on the on your handouts there. Which says, at the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had been laid. So this is where Jesus was buried, in a garden, in a new tomb, where there's been no hint of death before. Now, does that remind you of anywhere? Yeah, think Garden of Eden, right? This new place where there hasn't been any death yet. This garden. So in multiple ways, then John is leading his readers, leading us to understand that in the resurrection, the resurrection of Jesus, something new has begun. New creation has broken in, and for the first time since Genesis 3, where man's disobedience tore the world apart, here we see God and man are reunited in a garden. Isn't it beautiful how John is sort of weaving this story through these couple of chapters, that as you see them, you're just like, oh, isn't that beautiful? Before we move on, does anyone have any questions about sort of that and John's gospel for that? If not, let's bash out this next bit, so our final page on the handout. So we've got a quarter of an hour left. I think it will take me about that time to go through this, but hopefully we'll have some question time at the end as well at 3. So we're just going to look at here about how does Jesus' resurrection fulfill the central unifying symbols of Judaism. So it's my desire, like in this section, that we'll just bring a bit about a culmination, I suppose, of these themes that we've been looking at through this series. So monotheism, election, temple and Torah. So that's kind of the nature of God, the nature of his people, where God's presence dwells, and also God's people's relationship with the law. So in bringing these themes together, I hope that it will help sort of recap these major themes of the Gospels, but also emphasize the monumental significance that the resurrection has for Christian theology. So we'll move quickly through these areas. Like, please note down the passages I mentioned, like I won't be able to deal with them deeply today. I encourage you that in your own time that you have time just to sort of like read through them and think about sort of the resurrection and see how it applies to these different areas. I strongly encourage you guys to read further. So read into Acts, the rest of the New Testament, see how these themes are developed and teased out by the New Testament writers. But for now, let's start with thinking about monotheism. So that's the nature of God. And from very on early in this series, you may remember that we split this idea of monotheism into three different areas. So those were recognized as different areas of Jewish theology. So creation, ethics, and then covenant. So with this creational monotheism, we saw that there was only one creator God. And although there are many other sort of gods, they're idols, they are mere creations, fabrications, the people. So think of verses like Nehemiah 9, verse 6, which says, "You alone are the Lord. You have made the heavens, even the highest, and all their starry hosts, the earth and all that is on it, the sea and all that is in them. You give life to everything." Or Psalm 96, verse 5, "For all the gods of the peoples are idols, but the Lord made the heavens." And we also had ethical monotheism. So that is that only God can determine morality and is the guide by which ethics are measured. So think of the law that God gave to Israel through the Pentateuch, and the high regard in which it is kept throughout the entire Old Testament. So you can read through Psalms like Psalm 119, the longest chapter in the Bible. You'll find it's a celebration about God's law and God's role as a lawgiver. Then you also have covenantal monotheism, so that God has chosen for himself a people to be marked out by covenant. And these are found in all in lots of different places. So in Genesis 12, 15, 17 and 22, mark out God's covenants with Abraham. Then in Exodus, we get God's covenant at Sinai with the Hebrew people on the Exodus out from Egypt. And what we found throughout this series is how the life, the death and ministry of Jesus has started to change the disciples' thinking on these areas. But it's really the resurrection that kickstarts this transformation in their thinking. Think of it like introducing a rocket engine to a bicycle, like the increase of thrust that this would have been given. So their train of thought probably would have gone sort of something like this. So through the resurrection of Jesus, they showed that he was the true Messiah. So the Son of God and the Son of Man, that he is vindicated in this identity because he is not just another executed Messiah, but he has defeated death itself. Then there are Old Testament passages which spoke of the Messiah, not just ruling over Israel, but over all the nations. So it followed that the Son of God was not just for Israel, but was in fact the true Lord of the whole world. And when probed, these texts then seem to imply a sense in which the Lord shares the throne of God. So that this Messiah, this true Lord of the whole world, shares the throne with God. And yet Yahweh in the Old Testament frequently says, I share my glory with no other, which must mean that the Lord, to this Lord of the world, this Jesus, is actually none other than God himself. And you can see this worked out in passages in the New Testament as the apostles wrestle with its implications. So think of places like John 1, where he sort of reimagines this creation narrative. John is clearly wanting us to see that Jesus is the eternal Word of God through whom all things are created. Think about ethics. Acts 17, where Paul talks about Jesus having the power to judge all the nations. Or then covenant, so in places like 2 Corinthians 3 to 5, as Paul there dwells on the nature of the new covenant that Jesus established between God and his people. You can cross-reference that with the Last Supper, so say like Luke 22 verse 20, you know, where he talks about this cup of my blood being the new covenant. So Jesus' resurrection then begins to bring increasing definition to our idea about what God is like. So let's move on to consider election then and the nature of God's people. So we've seen in this series how Jesus, through his teaching and ministry, widened the Jewish understanding of what constituted God's people. He taught that it was not through Abrahamic lineage that meant you were counted as God's people, but rather it was God's people would be made up of those that put their faith in him. So you can look at Matthew 3 or 8 or Mark 3 and 7 for instances of this. And it's wonderful to see then the New Testament writers grab hold of this theme so strongly. And we see that we see this not only in the mission of the early church as they kind of go and tell everyone they can about the good news of Jesus, but we also see it explicitly stated through verses like 1 Peter 2, verses 9 to 10. Let me read those for you. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness and into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. So that's Peter wrestling with this theme. Or how about Colossians 3, verse 10? There Paul declares that there is no Greek nor Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and is in all. So Jesus then is forming this wonderfully diverse new community. I think we see even a great example of it here amongst us today. You join us for church and you see it amongst all the different people that are here. All possible because Jesus is the living Son of God who was raised from the dead, that he may draw this new people together. Let's then quickly look at temple and Torah as well. So if we think about the temple first, So Jesus' resurrection has profound implications for our thoughts about where God's presence dwells. So think of Jesus' statement in John 2, in which is used actually against him in his trial before his crucifixion. So you may remember that from last week. So it's where he says, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." So at the time, this statement kind of caused confusion amongst the disciples. But we see in retrospect, after his resurrection, indeed John writes this into his account, that they see that Jesus was saying something huge. That Jesus was, indicating that we no longer have to pilgrimage to a temple to be near God's presence in the Holy of Holies. Rather, we can enjoy God's presence anywhere. So as Jesus died, you'll remember that the temple curtain is torn in two from top to bottom. The old temple system of worship, the sacrificial system, is done away with. At Pentecost, we see God the Father sending his Holy Spirit to fill his church, which means for us that we are now somehow to be considered the temple of God. So as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 3:16, "Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's Spirit lives in you?" Astounding stuff, eh? As this implication of the resurrection is sort of wound through these different aspects of theology. How about let's think about, lastly, the Torah. So God's people and their relationship to the law. And as you kind of think this through in regard to the resurrection, you'll see that our relationship with the law and the Torah decisively changes too. So as the first disciples then contemplate Jesus' death on the cross, they see that it fulfills the requirements of the law for us, that he died in the place of the lawbreaker, that Jesus then took on the curse of the law so that we didn't have to ourselves. And if then the law is passed, then we are now free to live new lives of the Spirit because of the resurrection of Jesus. So you can read passages like Galatians 5, 16 to 26, where Paul fleshes this out in much more detail. Now, I know I've just skimmed through those different areas very quickly, but hopefully it gives you just a taste that you can see the immense significance that the resurrection has for our theology. It colours everything and the way that we see everything. Hopefully you can see as well some of the excitement that would have overtaken, I think, the early church as they wrestled with the enormity of this event that they had just witnessed, that they had seen God himself come, born into this world as a man, not only minister amongst us, but die and then rise again. You can imagine their eagerness then in the light of these events to reimagine and reassess, reexamine everything that they have been taught in the light of Jesus Christ, their resurrected Lord. And I think I'd very simply encourage us to do the same. Let's look at every aspect of our theology through this lens of Jesus Christ, not only the one who came, not only as the one who died, but the one who was raised again, and the new life then that gives us and that makes available to us. Now, I'd love to give a bit of time for any questions that you guys may have as a result of anything we've said in this. So we've got a couple of minutes. So if you guys have anything to say, or questions or comments. If not, I'll run into an outro. But any questions that you guys have?
Can I just ask you,
Andrew? Of course.
Just assuming that Jesus Christ didn't rise.
Yes.
What do you think will have happened?
Interesting that Paul deals with this very question in 1 Corinthians 15. Yes. So there he basically says, look, if Jesus did not rise again from the dead, your faith is futile, and that we as Christians should be pitied above all men. How strong is that? I often find this really interesting in apologetics or with chatting with friends about Jesus. And if you're kind of saying, why do you believe what you believe? I think the Bible clearly states it there for us. Look, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, this is pointless. What we do together here is pointless. We should be pitied. You should pity me for the time and money that I'm investing in this. So that's basically it. If he didn't, then this is worthless, yeah. Thankfully, he did. And Paul then uses the rest of the chapter to go, and so what does that mean for us? So if Jesus did rise again from the dead, then it colours everything wonderfully. Sorry, yeah.
I think sometimes we get into the false thinking that actually the people that
understood about one person being resurrected from the dead. But I get the impression actually neither the Jews nor any of the Greeks around them were expecting something like
that. No, not at all, yeah.
And that just makes me think, because often you sort of think, well, it must have been easier for them to explain to their contemporaries that Jesus had risen from the dead than it is for us to explain to ours. I was wondering if you had any, like, you were talking about speaking with your friends about it, if you have any ideas about how you, like, talk about Jesus rising from the dead, because it's just as alien now as it was then in that sense.
Yeah, I hear that, yeah. It's interesting, you can see examples. So when Paul, I can't remember which city he was teaching in, but it actually says that people thought he was talking about two gods, this guy named Jesus and resurrection. And so they wanted to hear him talk so much that he was talking about Jesus being raised from the dead. Yeah, I suppose there's a number of ways that you can think about it or talk about it. And I suppose people want to think about it in different ways as well. So sometimes it's cool to go through... just why we think that the resurrection happened. So sort of talking about the... just talking about the empty tomb, talking about there was no body, there were... and how that can happen. Like talking about alternatives and kind of saying, can you see how else... what else can explain the, like, sort of transformation in the disciples, the rise of the early church, but a significant event like the resurrection that often comes through quite interesting. There's a really good book, it's The Case for Christ by a guy named Lee Strobel. Yeah, he goes through this in quite a lot of detail, which is really good. So there's that level that you can do it on. I find it really interesting to think through the implications of it as well, just for thought and theology, like talking about it on that level. So like a good book, I think I've got it at the bottom of the handout, so Tom Wright's Surprised by Hope. It's just a great one for thinking... so there, I suppose, he grounds so much of this in sort of the Gospels themselves, like what would they have thought, but then moves on to sort of thinking about some of the implications for the way that we do life and church. And that really starts to... I think when you start talking about this new life, it just affects everything. And I find it crucial for helping people understand that my faith isn't just rule-keeping, as so often we assume religion is, but actually it's about something totally, totally different. Don't know whether that helped too much, but yeah. Any other? Oh, you may want to come back on these. Don't feel that it's just a one-off. Any other questions or thoughts?
You mentioned about like how to tell your friends about the resurrection, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is something I heard before. What you can do, right, is actually you can throw a curveball back at them, because you see, the Bible mentioned that Jesus did not raise spiritually, but he raised bodily. So which means that as long as someone can find a body that belongs to Jesus, the entire gospel, the entire Bible will just fall apart. But when the disciples can actually just say that, hey, he raised spiritually, but they did not say that. They say that he raised physically, bodily. So there must be some reasons why the disciples mention it in such a way, and why do they have such conviction. Because if you look at it, when you read on into history, like how all the disciples would be crucified, all of them were martyred for Christ, other than John, there must be a reason why they hold on to their faith so strongly. They can just mention spiritually, they don't need suffer, but they mention bodily and they choose that path.
Yeah.
There must be a reason why they hold on to their faith.
Yeah. Because it basically means our faith is falsifiable, which is really interesting. So rather than like our faith being built on a private revelation to one individual who then said, "Oh, I've heard this from God." No, rather we base it on something that's publicly falsifiable. So not only, you know, sort of the resurrection falsify that, it's done it, but even the way that Jesus goes about it, actually it was, he appeared to lots of people. Lots of, you know, it talks about 500 people seeing it at once. You know, it's a public revelation that's publicly discussed, which is quite a lot of fun. The band needs to get back on stage, so let me just finish by saying thank you so much for coming. We're thinking about how we continue to do Theology Matters, for how we make it compatible with the four services and things like that. So whether we do it on Saturday, so like took a day to do it, or whether we continue to do it on Sundays, where we do it and that sort of thing. So watch out for news on that. We're keen to keep keep this going. If you would like to give us any feedback, or would like, you know, just to say, oh, I'd really appreciate looking into this theme or that type of thing, do let us know as well, because we'd love to know what kind of you're hungry for to learn from. So if you'd like to do that, give that feedback. You can give it either to me or particularly to Liam, who's run this series. So his email is liam@christchurchlondon.org, and contact him there. Guys, thanks so much for coming. Hope you enjoyed today as much as you've enjoyed the rest of the series. And yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.